Hello there, everybody, for the town.
Hi there, Jordan.
All right, so who do we have? I see Bruce and Carrie. Welcome.
Thank you, Philip.
Hello.
All right, and Ellen and Jay Scott. Ellen, you may have to leave us, is that right, for some later on?
Yeah, I'm gonna try and hang out as long as I can.
Okay, sounds good.
And
hello, welcome.
Mr. Forsyth is joining.
Grant, welcome, Marilyn. I see you're there, welcome.
Good morning.
Okay, I think that's about it. And we have Glenn as usual, and I notice two members of the team from Secretariat as well, Alex and Philip.
Okay,
that gives us, yep.
Before we get started, can we kind of review our calendar for the Names Council meetings? Now, it's my understanding we have another one coming up in, 2 weeks, is that correct? Or are we meeting again next week?
No, I've given Glenn some new dates. Have they been posted yet, or are you about to do that?
They're on the website.
Because I noticed that the next meeting is on...
It's the 14th of May, the 29th, and the 6th of June.
Yeah, we're moving. Are we moving them all around day wise now, as opposed to just having them on Thursdays?
Ordinarily Thursday with a fixed time and place would remain the case. It was just for some other timetabling problems that we had to do that for two of those.
And I'm sorry, Glenn. I just come back on, and I heard you give the dates. Could I just get you to repeat them again? Sorry.
The 14th of May,
mm-hmm.
The 29th of May,
okay.
And the 6th of June, and they're all at 9 a.m. Eastern Time.
Excuse me, Carrie, did you say the 29th of May and the 6th of June?
That's right, 29th of May and the 6th of June.
With only 8 days intervening, okay.
Yeah, it was just...
I'll send out a mail after the meeting.
It was just that from having, I was basically spacing the meetings a fortnight apart while we're having these discussions, and then because we have ordinarily we hadn't got a June meeting arranged because we're physically meeting in Bucharest, but that didn't happen until the end of June, so it struck me that another one before that, and earlier rather than later in the month, might be useful in terms of preparation. That was all, Carrie.
Okay.
So, in the meantime, anybody else joined us? I don't think so. That's talk us about seven or so.
Look, it's Grant here. If no one else has joined us, can I just ask again, what was the last one? I got the 29th of May.
6th
June.
6th. Sorry?
Yes.
Week after.
Yes.
And that would be, so if that's, again, as you had said, that's so we should be prepared for the meeting in Bucharest and see what else we have to do between then.
Exactly. I mean, clearly things are going to be, or maybe coming more into focus in terms of what's actually going to happen with ICANN restructuring by Bucharest, so that gives...
I'm not sure that we won't need another shorter call even before Bucharest, because... I believe there will probably be further postings coming out after that time frame, and I think we probably tentatively ought to schedule a call just a day or two before people start traveling. We will be having documents posted.
Well,
that will be something.
I
like
one other question: when you say that the time is. Whatever time you said it was. Is that the same time as we have now?
Yes.
If we're going to do a meeting a day or two before somebody's traveling, I would suggest that rather than try to do it the Thursday prior to the ICANN meeting, we consider the possibility of rescheduling the meeting on June 6th to June the 13th. Because people, if they're starting to travel that weekend, it's going to be damn difficult to follow up on anything that might be any action items in the Names Council at that point.
Yeah, actually, Ken, I'm making a very different point, and I don't agree with changing the 6th. I think we will have plenty of work to do on the 6th to be making input and comments ourselves, but if there's going to be significant posting, which I think we should expect, to that we need to respond to while we are in Bucharest, it seems to me we probably would need to have at least a call. I'm just looking at the calendar now. In June, I'm leaving on Thursday night, which would be to travel, which would be, I think, the...
That's the 20th, Marilyn. That's what I'm saying. That was, you know, that's putting things too close to try to have a meeting. If you're going to have a meeting in June, other than the 6th of May, would propose the 17th rather than the end of the week.
I see. Yeah. So if we had a call on the, if we had a final call on the 17th in prep for our meeting in Bucharest, that might be something we should try to do.
Yeah, also I've checked and we may have potentially connectivity problems in Bucharest until ICANN gets everything up. Romania is not necessarily on the leading edge. I don't want to go through what we went through in Ghana where for 3 days straight it couldn't even connect. It doesn't do us any good if we arrive and can't get to our mail and follow up and respond.
Thank you, Council. We're now quiet. We're welcoming Laurence and Elisa Portaneuve, I noticed, is on my computer screen.
Hello.
Hello, good morning.
So we can start a moment. Just we're having a conversation then about a meeting, an extra meeting perhaps, to at least pencil in so people can be prepared for that. And I'll be saying probably Tuesday the 18th may be the best day for that.
I thought we were saying Monday.
I'm happy with either. Is there any...
Please, Philip, I'm afraid I didn't get your message.
Okay.
Do you plan yet another conference?
Yes, we're at the moment we're penciling in one, so... just so we have the slot available. This will be the week before Bucharest, in case there's any last-minute preparation. And we're suggesting either Monday, 17 June, or Tuesday, 18.
Let me check. I will give my answer in a few seconds.
Okay. Does anybody else have a preference for Monday or the Tuesday?
I have a preference for Monday.
Monday, are we comfortable with Monday? In that case, let's...
I am available both days.
Perfect. And let's pencil in Monday 17th as an extra meeting, Glenn, if you'd note that.
Yes, I know.
Can I just ask, is that meeting going to be in addition to or instead of the meeting of the 6th, given that the 6th is just 1 week after the meeting of the 29th?
This is Carrie. I'm tell you right here, and I will not be able to attend on the 6th.
Okay.
Philip, I was proposing it in addition to because I expect there to be considerable postings and things that we need to be responding to at the main council.
There's four meetings between now and Bucharest.
There are three definite and four probables, yes. This meeting we can easily cancel one. It's useful to have the slots penciled in, I think.
You say we have a quorum. Would you please take some sort of attendance so we know who's on the call?
Okay. Well, let me just run the list for speed. Besides myself, we have Tony Harris, Bruce. We have Carrie, Ellen, Grant, J. Scott, Ken, Laurence, Elizabeth, Marilyn. Plus a support team from the Secretariat. Kicking off with our agenda, which is very short today, I suggest perhaps we reverse items 1 and 2 on that. We just take the .org update briefly first. We then look briefly at recommendations left over from version 7, that's recommendations 14, 15, 16, and then go on to a broader discussion about policy development mechanisms within the structure of the advisory bodies that we've already outlined. Anything else for discussion? Nope, I'm hearing silence, so that's fine. Let's take item 2 first then. Dr. Task Force, Elizabeth, have you had any success in starting discussions yet?
Well, yes. We reconvened the Names Council Task Force, and we had a teleconference call last Tuesday with Louis Touton. Over that call, we were looking on implementations details on several aspects requested to be put into request for proposal. I believe it was very interesting discussion. Louis Touton sent out the URL for draft request for proposal this morning at 5 a.m. on DOTS, and I was online and I forwarded it to the Names Council Task Force member for reading. I didn't have time to read it yet. We were considering in our discussion with Louis Touton to gather information on the current.org registry operation size, number of domain names, distribution of expiration data per year, and this kind of factual information to be able to figure out what kind of requirement are necessary to put to the new .org registry. The main difference between new .org registry and new GTLD registry is actually there are two differences. The first one is that it is a huge registry under operation, so there is nothing which there will be no sunrise period and anything related to sunrise difficulties, but because it is operational registry, taking over of 7 million domain names is not neutral and should be taken into account from implementation and operations.
Okay, thank you. That was Philippe Grovens, who is joining us.
Yes.
Hi, you're very welcome. We're just, and Roger Kachetian, it is also...
I'm sorry for being late.
No problem. So, Elizabeth, are you hopeful you're going to be able to meet the short deadlines you have on this?
Well, we have a short deadline, which is 8th of May, as far as I recall. It was the deadline you set for ourselves. We are lucky to have this to have had this discussion with Louis Touton, to have now the RFP draft proposal online, and eventually have 6 full days to read it and to comment. And I do hope we are going to have some of them, but we need time to read it. It was released at 5 a.m. this morning.
Hi, this is Oscar.
Oscar, you're very welcome. So are there questions for Elizabeth?
Yes. Elizabeth, you said you...
I had a couple of places for saying questions. Yes, Marilyn, I was hearing and somebody saying yes. Who was that?
Jay Scott.
Jay Scott. Anybody else? Okay, Marilyn, go ahead.
My first question is that I thought Elizabeth said she forwarded it to the council.
No, I did not yet forward it to the Names Council. I got the message from Louis Touton. It was 5 a.m. my time. I re-forwarded it to the Names Council Task Force, and I was really very overloaded. Believe me, I will do so just after the call.
That's all I was trying to clarify. Thanks.
Thanks.
Andrew
Scott?
Two questions. One,
I just wanted to know, I thought I'd seen a message where Kerry had said that he would like to be involved again and wanted to confirm that to clarify whether he was going to take over as the chair since Elizabeth had taken this on as in an interim basis, provided, you know, Kerry's second question is, I also know that the IPC, and I believe there was another constituency, maybe the ISPs, needed to nominate someone to this committee and wanted to know how we needed to do that.
My answer to your all your question is we have very short time. Everybody is overloaded. Whoever wants to participate in the .org task force for this particular work, which consists to read a request for proposal and to provide comments, is very welcome. Please ask. Glenn will add people to the list, and we have only 6 days, so it is absolutely no problem.
Right. I think, Carrie, you did say yes, and I take it you're now still part of the task force. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was a party to the meeting that was about which Elizabeth reported, and if anybody's looking for a volunteer for any grunt aspect of what's going to happen in the next days, I'm available. But
okay. And on the email that I had posted on the 25th. I was reminding, I think, the non-commercial, the IPC and the ISP, that they are invited to nominate one representative. And has that happened, Elizabeth?
I don't think so. I don't recall to have anyone from either of these three groups.
Right. Jay Scott, do you want to...
Do you want to join?
I've got someone I'd like to nominate, but I don't know if she'll do it. Ellen? There?
I'm here. I have a little bit of problem in that I'm not going to be available for the next 3 days, so it cuts it out for the initial time framework, but I'll be happy, Scott, if you want me to assist you in catching up at the end.
Okay. Okay, anyway, my constituency sort that out yourself. You're more than welcome to nominate somebody and have them on the list immediately. So some clarification.
I'm sorry, Philip. I made a mistake. We have Milton Miller from non-commercial constituency.
Okay.
And he was on the call. I'm sorry.
Carrie, yes? In the ICANN timetable for what happens next with the RFP, there is a this May 8th, whatever it was, deadline where the Names Council is to speak as to whatever is necessary vis-a-vis our commentary on the thing. Is it the purpose of the reconvened task force to be the voice of this action?
I think we're asking the task force to make a recommendation to the Names Council, which, according to the timetable, we're going to have to give support to, I think, by email.
So we're not talking about a supplementary task force report. We are talking about a Names Council commentary with some portion of the impetus of that being provided by the resurrected task force.
Exactly.
Philip, this is Ken Stubbs. Can I speak for a second?
Yes.
Yeah, it's not really a point of order, but I think it's a guideline. It would appear that there's a possibility that the IP people might need to reach back in order to get some additional assistance. I'd like to remind people that Milton Miller is not a member of the Names Council, and frankly, I would, as a member of that task force, I would have no problem at all if the IP constituency decided that they wanted to nominate somebody to work on the task force on their behalf. I think it's more important that they have the opportunity to provide reasoned and deliberated input than it is to worry about who is actually providing that input on the task force. So I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you for that. So does that conclude discussion on .org?
Yes.
Perfect. Then let's move on to item one, which we had skipped over. Now we're talking about recommendation version 7, and there were just some outstanding discussion items on that, which start with which I had attempted to capture a little bit of discussions that we'd had on our last call, although we hadn't discussed those in detail, and just taking some top line parts of the original draft. These are recommendations 14, 15, and 16. Recommendation 14 reads, board elections. The advisory bodies should elect or select a selection of board members. Are we, without going into any details at this point, are we happy with that general statement?
Selecting a selection doesn't leave me all that thrilled.
So elect or select.
Yes, but I don't think the sentence reads well. There's no substantive comment here. It's just that
select a selection.
It doesn't seem all that elegant.
Yeah, perhaps we need a better select a part, a portion.
A number of.
That's good.
Yeah.
Okay, I can take that as a friendly amendment. Other comments of substance? Who wants to speak to that?
Well, I'd like to speak to them.
That was Marilyn?
Yeah.
Anybody else?
Ellen,
anybody else?
Bruce talking.
Bruce, anybody else? Okay, let's start off with that. Marilyn.
I think I'm fine with this, but I just want to make sure that we are all in agreement that by stating it this way, we are accepting the concept of ex officio board members coming into the process that are selected in another manner, and such as, for instance, I would have to think about how they might get there, and I'm not sure we've addressed how those other board members would get there. If we, for instance, were suggesting that the board could be composed of voting and non-voting members, which I think we may be saying, I just want to be sure that we understand what we're saying. If the board can be composed of voting and non-voting members, and some members would then be appointed to non-voting positions, that would be point number one. Point number two would be the advisory bodies, as this reads, would elect or select a number of, I assume we mean voting board members. And we might want to clarify that.
Okay, Marilyn. So what we're saying at the moment is simpler than the analysis you're proposing. All we're saying at the moment is the advisory bodies should be part of the decision process for some of the board members. This naturally means that there is another process for the rest of board members. Can you explain to me you're envisaging a possible future board in which there would be voting members and non-voting members. There'd basically be a non-voting member of a board and an advisor to the board. Is that the sort of thing you mean?
Yes, and I think that's been tossed around a bit, the idea that, and we mentioned it, I believe, the BC mentioned it in our paper, that, for instance, the GAC chair could be a non-voting advisory, in a non-voting advisory status to the board.
Okay.
I think
certainly the intent of the drafting here was that this would be board members in the normal sense, so they would be voting board members, so for clarity, we should perhaps say voting board members. That's what your point is it?
That's one of my points. My second point would be that if we are going to, that we probably need to address, not necessarily in recommendation 14, but we need to address what our views are on the process by which others ascend to the board.
Sure. Okay, then let's put that aside for future discussion there, but that's a good point. I'll make a note. Ellen.
Yes, I'm a little bit confused by what you mean by the advisory body. Are we offering this in lieu of the nominating committee? Are we saying that some of the board members could be by advisory body?
What we're saying is, because earlier in the document we talk about the fact that we believe there should be an advisory body for the GTLDs and an advisory body for the CCTLDs, and we're saying that given the existence of those advisory bodies, they should participate in the process of voting, of electing or selecting a number of voting board members. So it simply means that they should be a part of that process and is silent on how other things should happen. But what it implies is that indeed not all selection should be by a nominating committee if that is a mechanism chosen for other board members.
I was just confused because advisory body is being tossed around in a lot of different contact.
Okay, so perhaps I should make reference to the early recommendation for clarity. I can have
Philip Carey to speak, please.
Carey, I'll add you to the list.
Tony Harris also.
And Tony Harris on the list. Bruce, where's next to speak?
Thanks, Philip. Yeah, I guess I was a bit confused about what we mean by advisory bodies, but I gather if we were using the language as Stuart's proposed, we'll be talking about policy councils, presumably. In Stuart Lee's proposal, the GTLD, GTLD bodies are called policy councils.
Right, yeah, indeed.
I think the position of registrars at the moment is...
Excuse me, Mr. Harold Feld is joining.
The position of registrars at the moment is, if we take the proposal that Stuart Lynn has, he's got five people appointed by the government, or by governments, five people appointed by a nominating committee, five people appointed by, or selected by the advisory bodies or policy councils. The registrars are basically saying that rather than have five people appointed by the nominating process, they would expand that to 10 and not have five directly nominated by government. So the end result would be 10 people nominated by a nominating committee and five people which would be selected by the advisory councils. We also accept the view, I think, that Marilyn had, that we would see that the chair of the GAC would be a non-voting member, mainly to have a stronger liaison with the GAC and the board, and that there'd also be a non-voting trustee from the Internet Architecture Board, also primarily there is a liaison between the Internet Architecture Board of the IETF and the board.
Okay, so what we're saying at the moment is certainly consistent with that, and that goes into greater detail. I must say, I think the idea of certain people participating in the board in a non-voting way, like, for instance, the chairman of the GAC, I think has a great merit to it. Maybe we want to expand that in a moment if we're reaching agreement on that. Carey, you were next to speak.
On the same point, I wonder if being a non-voting board member is in fact a weaker position than being a voice of an advisory body with a right to attend board meetings. That the advisory bodies shall designate representatives who will attend board meetings and may speak at board meetings, rather than putting some sort of a clawless version of a board member on the board.
Right. Yes, so they, indeed, there could be a difference in their judicial power, but I think...
Fine line.
There's also the constitutional issue of whether I can, whatever the remaining normative document may be, dictating ICANN's procedures, if that allows for the notion of a non-voting board member. Maybe it does already, I don't know.
Okay. Tony Harris, next in line.
Yes, I'd like to confirm what our constituency, the ISPCP, stated in our comments, which were forwarded to the Names Council a couple of days ago, and we offer no support for a revised structure which has as a part advisory committees. So obviously we're uncomfortable with this statement. I think it, by saying this, we're invalidating the advisory committees as something which might happen. And we don't particularly agree with them with this.
Are we confusing language, Tony? What I'm referring to here in the phrase "the advisory bodies should elect" is the what we have currently under recommendation 12 and 13, which is a advisory body for GTLDs and advisory body for CCTLDs, sort of counterparts to what the DNSO is at the moment, or those functions the DNSO at the moment. Are you saying that you disagree with those, or are you disagreeing with
the term advisory bodies? We're comfortable with the supporting organization concept.
Oh, right, okay, so you're fine. I think the language here is not supposed to be weaker than supporting organization. We're just trying to use a more generic term.
We're just concerned that anything that we say, at least from our point of view, should confirm or convey the impression that we're happy with this proposed restructuring.
Okay.
Philippe?
Elizabeth?
I must echo what Tony Harris is saying. I am also concerned that by what we are saying here, we may convey the message that we agree with the proposal.
Elizabeth, are you speaking for the CCs or are you speaking for yourself there?
I am speaking, I cannot speak formally for CC because we didn't have time to have whatever approval. But when I gather all information and all communique and all certitude we have, it is not necessary. One thing is absolutely certain, that we agree with the analysis that there are problems, and there is another one which is sure that we don't necessarily agree with the proposal. Therefore, structure of ICANN 2 is part of this proposal. Just let me clarify more. We of course are considering the future, but by considering details, going into details as we do, we may give perception that we consider Stuart's proposal as valid. Stuart, the structure of 15 people as valid. At this point of time, I don't know, for instance, what will happen, what will be the answer from governments with regard to 5 seats. So I don't want to be negative, but just to flag that we shall not give the perception that the structure of new ICANN 2 as proposed is just needs a small adjustment.
Sure. I think it's okay. What I'll do is, because under recommendations in Act 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13, we've already defined the principal characteristics of the advisory bodies as we want them. So what I can simply do under recommendation 14 is rephrase it as follows. The advisory bodies, such as those referred to in recommendations 9 to 13, should elect or select a number of voting board members. I think that captures the concern about seeming to weaken things there. That was Mario speaking again. Anybody else?
Joe Scott.
Hey, Scott. Anybody else?
Bruce Thompson.
And Bruce. Anybody else? Okay, let's go with
Marilyn. So if I want to address the point maybe a little bit differently than you did, because I went back and looked at Recommendation 9, and listening to what Tony said, I really, I might offer slightly different language. If you remember, I added on the heading, Advisory Bodies and Policy, I added the policy development to advisory bodies. I think we probably ought to add the words, ICANN, policy development / advisory bodies, to make it clear that we are not accepting an advisory only status in the policy development, because I do think it would be easy, when I listen to Tony, I do think it would be easy for people to be confused that, particularly in recommendation 14, we're saying the advisory bodies, the BC by no means suggests advisory status only on policy development. So I think we should try to strengthen and clarify. We are talking about our own definition.
I'm comfortable to take that as a friendly amendment as well. So it would read the ICANN policy development / advisory bodies to pick up the description we had earlier.
We're clear. We've got to be clear that we cannot allow this to be misinterpreted as Stewart's definition.
Well, Marilyn, taking off from your comment, why don't we just title the section ICANN Policy Development Bodies, ICANN
okay.
Policy Development Body, to take the term
mm-hmm.
advisory out of there altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And that way we don't, it doesn't get misinterpreted by using that term, which is prevalent throughout Stewart's paper, that somehow we were saying we want his policy council model. Is it?
Philip, would you put me in line, please?
So it would just read ICANN Policy Development Bodies, and then in 12 and 13 it should say create a new policy advisory body for the CCTLD and create a new policy advisory body for the TTLD.
I'm happy with the change of language. I mean, we're using that phrasing earlier. In fact, ICANN Policy Advisory Bodies is clearly critical language. We can agree to be consistent with use of that language whenever we refer to them in this document. I can make those changes.
Yeah, and rather than saying advisory, just say policy development bodies. Take out the word advisory altogether. So it shows that it's an active role. It is a role that develops policy and has more than just an advisory level.
Okay. I'm happy that change if everybody else proves to be. Jay Scott, that was you. Bruce, you're next.
Yeah, I just got to reinforce that. I think, Stuart, there is the concept of a technical advisory committee and a government advisory committee in the Stuart proposal, and I guess actually in the current ICANN structure in a way. I think by using the term advisory, we can create the wrong impression, so I would strongly support the use of the term policy development body instead throughout this.
Philip, this is Rockfell. Can you put me in the queue, please?
Harold, you're on the queue. Ken, you're next.
I'm a little confused and I suppose somewhat frustrated, and I'd appreciate it if someone could help me out here. It seems like we got specific and now we're getting nebulous. My feeling is if we're going to do what Jay Scott recommended, which I happen to agree with, I think we should be very specific as to exactly what structure or what nature this body is that we keep referring to, and I think we need to do it more than once, because I'm seeing inconsistencies in use and definition in the other recommendations now. So I guess whether or not we start out with some sort of term or definition, it probably would not hurt in our recommendations to start out with a list of definitions so that we're specific enough so they know that when we refer to this body or this body, committee or whatever it is, this is exactly what we mean by that, because it's a big difference between, like Jay Scott said, between advisory and functional. So,
I think what you're saying, I'm happy to take language on that, although I think to some extent anything that's important about the definition, I think, is probably what we're trying to define in these recommendations. But certainly, as you say, being consistent with the description is going to be useful. That was Ken. We have Harold next.
Yes. First, I'm sorry to... Ouch. I want to agree with Marilyn's point regarding policy formulation, which raises, in my mind, a problem that perhaps... is not to be dealt with in this particular conversation, but is something that worries me as we're putting this language in, which is how is the board ultimately going to be held accountable to follow the policies that are developed by these policy formulation bodies? If the board takes the position as it has as it did in OCRA, that advice is just advice and that the ultimate decision lies with the board, it doesn't matter whether we call it advisory committee or policy formulation, it's still going to be just advice.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for that. Anybody else want to comment on that, or are we now clear on the wording we want for that?
Philip, it's Marilyn.
Yeah?
I am happy with this wording as long as we have, we go into these other discussions, and Harold's, I think, would be one discussion that we would need to go into. The other thing I think we would need to go into would be the actual composition of the board. And so maybe what we ought to do is sort of come up with a list of additional...
Okay, well, I mean, you made a point earlier about board composition. I made a note of that for discussion earlier on the agenda. We have policy development as our main topic of today, and I hope we're going to come
back. I'm happy with that. I just wanted to ask you if you would take a list of the additional topics
that we... So, policy development is probably enough for today. Perhaps we can email other topics for the future. Jay Scott.
I think, to Ken's point, just quickly, I think one crucial question that we're going to have to answer both for the Pasante Committee and for ourselves is when we say the ICANN policy development bodies, and we use that there should be a policy development body for the CCs and a policy development body for the GTLDs, the question that looms in my mind, and I'm certain looms in the committee's mind, is what do those bodies consist of? And
yes, that I think is what we're about to discuss.
Okay.
The main,
right. I thought that's what we were, but I just wanted to...
Absolutely. Okay, if we're happy with 14, let's move on to 15, which is board size. Currently reads, the board should be set at a size that balances two goals, large enough to be representative, small enough to be functional. Are we happy with that statement of principle? Anybody to comment, support?
Yeah, Laurence. It's...
Laurence, anybody else?
Tony Harris.
Hey, Scott, anybody else?
Tony Harris. Yeah, Grant here.
Tony Harris, Grant, anybody else? Okay, let's start with Laurence.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to know what is the objective of this recommendation.
It brings in two earlier thoughts that we had, one of which was the size of the board... in order to make it operate as a board and be able to take decisions, you normally need a board to be a certain size and not too big for that to happen. However, the competing objective against having a small board is that for a global organization like ICANN, you want your board to be representative, and of course, to be more representative tends to mean the board gets bigger and bigger. So what we're saying here is that in any new construct, these are the two factors that should be taken into account in considering the size of the board before we get too excited one way in terms of making it functional and working, or being super representational. We need to think of the balance.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's already a statement of principle, as you said, so I'm not sure it adds anything as a recommendation.
As a recommendation, it means that those people are saying only the board is representative. It means to say, wait a minute, there are other things to think about. Statements of the blindingly obvious to some of us are statements of controversy to others. Jay Scott, you are next.
I just think that the sentence we have now is fine, but it leaves the unanswered question, and that is a specific recommendation that I think we are compelled to make, and that is a specific recommendation that number is and how that number will break down. I think we're moving to that discussion, but I think that needs to be, this recommendation should be board size and composition, and it needs to get specific.
Yeah.
Could you put me in the queue, please, Philip? It's Ken.
Sure. So I'll make a note also then about board size recommendation for Jay Scott. Thanks. We have Tony Harris next.
What about
Carrie? Yes. Carrie,
okay. Had you asked me on the list as well?
Yeah, I thought you put me there.
Sorry, I had Grant and Ken on the list. I can certainly put you down and take Ken there. Okay, so it's Tony Harris.
Yes, I'd just briefly like to again confirm what we said in our comments. The ISPCP does not support the reduction of the current number of board seats. since initiatives for new supporting organizations of CCTRDs and at large have yet to be resolved and thus may require board representation. I think the sentence we have, where we say it's small enough to be functional, leaves a window for Stuart Lynn to achieve his purpose, which is to reduce it to 15 seats. So I'm not too happy with that.
Okay, but you are, I mean, your statement of the board shouldn't be reduced is based on a goal of representation, presumably.
I think, I don't know if we should say large enough to be representative. It should be large enough to achieve the purpose of due representation for such a large geographic and stakeholder diversity.
Sure. Okay. And Grant was next.
Yeah, I was just going to say my reading of the recommendation as it stands at the moment is that it, maybe it is stating the blindingly obvious, but I don't think, all it does is beg the question, well, yes, but how many? I mean, I think the two requirements are admirable. They don't go, I don't think, anywhere to actually assist in determining what an appropriate number of members.
Well, but that comes up to the question that we want to talk about subsequently, because in terms of how many is also the question of is who, and that is all the question of board composition, which we will get onto, I think. But that's not right here. You're absolutely right in what you say. And Carrie was next.
Okay, it's actually pretty much been said, but there's some suggestion here that we think there might be some other alternative. This is an organizational conundrum. Every board needs to strike precisely this balance. And by stating that in this particular case, we're almost suggesting that we figure there is an imbalanced model that otherwise might be appropriate.
Thank you. That's one interpretation. sometimes when you okay.
I think we need to provide concrete guidance. Every time the names count, not every time, but often when the names council's recommendations are dismissed, the tactic is saying that they're wonderful recommendations, but they don't provide much in the way of concrete guidance. And in this particular case, I think concrete guidance is exactly what we're looking for, rather than, again, what I think many of us feel to be an obvious statement.
Okay. No, I mean, I'm as happy to make a document as concrete as possible. The difference is, the problem is that as soon as you get down to too many specifics, we typically find there are different constituency views, and therefore we have to rely on concrete guidance being at the constituency level rather than the council level, but certainly where we can agree on those concrete proposals, I'd be the first one to do so. Ken?
Yes. First of all, I wanted to echo Jay Scott's comments about the specificity as to carry. I think we're getting to the point where if we can't be specific, then frankly, putting in a recommendation like this, it becomes meaningless. It should be large enough to work. That's literally what we're saying, and that's what it's a meaningless statement. I mean, we're all agreeing that it should work. I think if we aren't willing to put in try to get to the point where we have some specific recommendations in this area, then we should refer the board to the statements by the constituencies, because what I see here is that we're afraid to get too specific, because the minute we get too specific, we disagree. So let's just make a statement that there just isn't any consistency amongst the constituencies as to composition of the board, and refer the board to the constituency statement. Why do we have to work to achieve some sort of consensus on a useless, bland statement? And I am faulting it. It's meaningless, that's all. Large enough to be representative, small enough to be functional, that's sure as bland as it gets. Thank you.
Can I get in queue?
Okay, Scott, I just have to ask a quick, how do you mute? So that I'm trying to eat breakfast, and I want to know how to mute. Why?
I believe star 10 mutes. Is that right, Glenn?
Star
6.
Star 6.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bruce Tonkin, if you can put me in the queue as well.
Wait a minute, I've got Matt in the queue. That was Bruce, was it?
Yes.
And who else? Anybody else?
Sean.
And Sean. Anybody else? Okay, Marilyn.
I would support what I think Jay Scott was proposing earlier, changing the heading to board size and composition, keeping the sentence, and having a discussion about composition and characteristics of board members that I think is worth our having as a discussion, even if we don't come to an absolute agreement on it. We could, for instance, end up in a space where we broadly support that the board should be between the number 15 and 19. I'm just throwing some ideas out for later discussion. The board should be between 15 and 19. It should be composed of the following kinds of representatives, and even if we can't come to an absolute agreement, I think this would be the place we would put our discussion about the role of ex officio and non-voting versus voting. And that would be helpful to the evolution of the reform committee and to the community at large as a discussion.
Sure. I think that's something we can attempt. I'm simply not trying to avoid having a discussion now, because what we had tabled is discussion about policy development. I think we should try to focus onto that as soon as we can and have these more detailed discussions in terms of board size, representation, voting, non-voting, election, etc., as another topic for probably a future call, or the end of this call if we're quicker than we have proved in the past. Bruce, you're next.
Yeah, actually, I was pretty much going to say what you just said there, Philip. I mean, I think, unless we're clear on what the process is, you can't, and what the function of the board is, you can't really decide what the membership should be. If the board ends up being the only place where policy is developed, then of course everyone wants to be on the board. If the board is a place where basically you're making sure that the process is working and all the policy development is done in the other areas, then it's irrelevant. You don't need hundreds of people on the board. And I think we should just move on to the next topic and then come back to this.
Excellent. Thank you for that.
Ken Stubbs, put me back in the queue, please.
Ken, you're back in the queue. And June, you're next.
In my view, pulling the number of board members and the size is not significant at the moment, because I think the main problem, differences of our opinions depends on the function of board. At first look, in many aspects, just now the function of the board seems to be very similar to that of the DNSO. So in a sense, board looks like one extended DNSO structure. So up to now, one of important principles we had was to build a consensus among different stakeholders. Then the principle is being weakened, and the coordination and to building up consensus among different interest groups or non-interest groups is such a function is disappearing, and in a sense it is going to the body itself. So I think that point is more important than the total size of board.
Sure, thank you very much for that. Ken, you're next.
Philip, can you just summarise that a little bit? I don't know about others, but I couldn't hear much of that. Something strange in the line.
I think Trump was saying that, in particular, the degree of representational is and access in terms of the board and how that might function is more key than simply talking about numbers, which I think is moving in the same direction that we were saying earlier, that we need to be clearer about the role of the board before we can speak directly about its size. Was that a good summary?
One of the difficulties I feel just now is what's the correct relations between relationship between policy development bodies and a board? It's unclear to me. And also, all policy development bodies independent. For example, GTLD, policy development body, is almost independent, and also CCTLD, policy development body, is independent. So where is the function of coordination among different interest groups? Is it both?
Good open question, Chun. Anybody is very welcome to answer it if they can. In the meantime, Ken is next on the list.
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to echo Marilyn's statement about having a little bit more specific discussions on board functions and size. I think that almost every member of the board that I talk to, and members of the staff and people, echo the same requests and concerns. First of all, the policy development, and the second thing was trying to develop some sort of approach to dealing with composition and structure of the board. So I think we would be remiss in not having that discussion, and even if we cannot agree on specifics, I think that there would be enough meat in the discussions that I think a discussion like that really needs to be very, very carefully documented, and I would actually probably take those specific minutes and add them on in the form of some sort of a documentary supporting any specific recommendations we have in that area. It's somewhat troubling to me that the board doesn't have more of an opportunity to monitor some of our discussions, because I think there are some definite things they could walk away from. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that, Ken. Okay. Bruce. Bruce, are you with us? Maybe not. Well, we'll come back to Bruce if he reappears. But, Bruce, you're muted at the moment, I notice. You need to press, I think, star 6 to unmute yourself. Muted and absent. So, what I would recommend is that certainly, I think, for next discussions after we talk about policy development, we would cover board and related topics, as everybody has been suggesting, and that will probably be our next call. But in the meantime, are we happy to adopt the wording recommendation 15? I think I haven't heard anybody fundamentally objecting to it in what it says, only that it should be saying more, which we will be discussing later.
So if it's Marilyn, I had made a proposal that you change the heading, but I support adopting the wording as is at this time.
So the heading where it says board composition wanted to change?
It would say board size and composition.
Board size competition. I think I can probably take that as a
friendly amendment. It's intended to be friendly. I'm smiling.
But Marilyn, you're always smiling.
Ah.
Okay. So are we happy with 14, with 15, so I can move on to 16? Okay. 16 is in two parts. It just talks about independent review. The first is a statement saying create a committee for independent review to oversee the work of a professional ombudsman. So two parts of that, one of which is that there should be a committee. I'm not saying yet how that should happen for independent review, and that committee's major function should be overseeing the work of a professional ombudsman. In other words, there should be somebody who is a paid professional who is doing the job day to day, and there is a committee who oversees that work. So in other words, the committee itself, as part-timers, aren't responsible for it. We have somebody full-time who is there for those functions. Now, the second sentence, I think, there's been some email discussion about that, and it was one suggestion for how that committee could be constructed, and currently reads, the committee could comprise a designee of the GAC, a designee of the IAB, the past board members, and an ombudsman. In other words, the ombudsman himself would be a part of that
committee. So your thoughts and comments on one or both parts of that, who would like to be on the list?
Gary?
Marilyn, yeah. Please do give your name rather than my name or personal pronoun. It helps me.
Tony Harris.
Tony? Anyone else?
Roger.
Roger. Anyone else? Okay, I'll do for now. Carrie.
I'm working backwards. I don't think it should be then an ombudsman. It should be the ombudsman. There's no
To make sure that we get, so in terms of referring back here, I'm happy to adopt that.
And then moving to the left of the comma before that, past board members, how are they designated? Is this an en masse thing, whoever wants to be around, or does somebody select from among them?
Well, indeed, we're not in this sentence referring to the selection process at all, but merely who could be in the group of those selected.
Well, we're speaking about the GAC designating its voice. We're speaking about the IAB designating its voice.
Well, the question is it the board designating past board, or is it some other group, a nominating committee designating past board? Yeah. Do you have a preference to suggest?
No, other than that we have to be absolutely certain that this doesn't end up being another one of these 1,500 person strong bodies before everything's said and done.
Indeed. Okay. Marilyn, next.
Actually, my comment is that this does not actually capture quite what the DC intended, so let me describe what we intended. We felt that two functions are required. This could be cohabitated, so to speak, or some other better term than that. There needs to be an independent review process, and I think this goes to the point that Harold made earlier. There needs to be some kind of an independent review process that a serious appeal that the board has violated its mission or board bylaws or something of that nature could be appealed to, and that there needs to be an ombudsman function that is staffed and supported that can do the necessary investigations in order to make recommendations. And I think more thinking.
Why wouldn't the ombudsman be the recipient of the appeal or the complaint?
The ombudsman function that we were envisioning, Philip, there are a number of complaints that are received by the staff, the board, and chair of various task forces at this time from people. And there's no effective process for advising on dealing with those complaints. And I think we're envisioning that an ombudsman would be working at a more tactical level than an independent review committee that was described here, but that the overall process, because we're addressing transparency here, that the two processes should have some relationship to each other.
So this is Harold. Can I get in the queue, please?
Harold, I can't add you to the queue. I think what you're saying, Martin, sort of perhaps addresses the process of this in greater detail again than is outlined here.
Philip, it actually addresses the purpose in greater detail.
So you're saying that there could be some things of complaint that would go to a professional ombudsman who has his work overseen by this committee.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other things that the committee would do as well.
That's right. And one of the things...
An example of those as well things is what?
Making a review of complaints that the board has violated the bylaws.
Why wouldn't you have an ombudsman doing that?
I don't really think you can find perhaps you could find Nelson Mandela once he retires, who would be able to take on sainthood and be able to play that role and be above any...
Come on,
Philip, I'm being serious
about this. In half-dozen countries, you have consumer ombudsmen who are...
Consumer ombudsmen do not review or take under advisement the kind of review process, and I think I should probably defer this and let Harold speak on it, but and then I want to come back on it. There's a real difference here between helping to ensure there's an effective complaint process that's resolved and a serious appeal or complaint that is made that the board has violated the bylaws.
In other words, Marilyn, you see the ombudsman as being a facilitator, not a decision maker.
Right. And tactical.
Yeah. So I have comments on the same subject, but I'll just note that until I get my turn.
Okay, well, that's kind of discussion forward. I think it's, I still feel it's leaning a little towards the process as to, okay, what does the committee do, what does the ombudsman do, how much power do you give the ombudsman? Whereas what I was trying to capture...
Let me finish.
I'm just saying what we may need then is a form of word, unless we all absolutely bind to that point, it's a form of word that doesn't suggest that couldn't be part of what we're saying. That's what I'm trying to get to. But we can doubtless come back to you. And Tony Harris was next in the queue.
I just have a short question. I must confess I lost track of this, but I think some time back there were some references to such a committee for independent review. In fact, they were looking for some retired judges, I think, who would participate. Did that go away, or did anything come of it?
I think that committee exists. I remember making recommendations for the nominating committee for that committee, I think, if I recall. And that is in operation, as far as I'm aware.
No, Philip.
Because then we would essentially be proposing a second body with the same name, independent review.
No.
We're saying a body of that way.
It's not in existence.
Marilyn, then clarify what the status is of that process we went through to nominate.
My understanding is, and I've had long discussions on this, but again, Harold may be more up to date than I am. They've been unable to reach a decision on how they would make any appointments. It's totally stymied.
Well, I thought we had a didn't we? Oh, so well, the problem was the nominating committee was created, but not the actual review committee.
Right.
And in fact, this is how my understanding is that in fact they decided in Accra that because the nominating committee could not move forward, they were just going to table this.
Yes.
Okay. So perhaps saying up front who should be on such committee is a good move, and is perhaps a an interesting watch out for the role of any nominating committee. I don't know. Anyway, thank you for that clarification. Roger was next in the queue.
It might be useful to review a little bit of history and put this subject in context. And before doing so, I want to say that I agree entirely with Marilyn Cade's comments. She's trying to explain two very different things, each of which has a different role or a different function. But first, to distinguish between the two subjects we're talking about, many large organizations and most medium to large sized companies have what Americans historically have called a complaint department, and what Europeans have called ombudsman, and the concept is that this is a place where people can go if they have a complaint. This is a place where people can go if they don't think they're being treated well or treated fairly. And normally, not always, but normally, an ombudsman or the head of a complaint department is a part of the management team of the organization they work for. They are hired by or fired by the management of that organization, and their job is to work with them to try to make sure that complaints are addressed quickly and fairly. It's uncommon, and certainly not part of the ICANN reorganization proposal, as I read it, that the ombudsman would be utterly and entirely independent with their own budget and their own independent ability to overrule the ICANN board. They're viewed as somebody who has full-time responsibility to deal with problems or complaints when they come up. That's an important concept And it's important for concept, especially for anybody who deals with the public. ICANN does not have a lot of dealings with the public, so how relevant it is to ICANN is another matter, but it is an important idea I think most people would support. There's a completely different idea that Marilyn was trying to explain a moment ago, which is more akin to the role that, at least in the United States, the courts play with regard to regulatory or legislative bodies, and that is you have an independent review body that has the ability to overturn decisions if those decisions go beyond their authority or are arbitrary or capricious or inconsistent or personally motivated or any of a number of things to ensure that there's some consistency in the way that organizations act. And that's an organizational check. That's a control. That's part of the governance of organizations. And it, again, in American systems, it's normally thought of as sort of a part of the idea of due process, that there's a review or a control to limit arbitrary action, so that if an American regulatory agency, you know, imposes a fine on somebody because the chairman of the agency doesn't like him or he's the neighbor and, you know, did something unpleasant to him, then the person goes to a review body called a court and says this was unfair or that's outside of their jurisdiction or whatever the case is. So these are completely different concepts. Marilyn is making, I think, a very important point that the recommendations now don't address this oversight, and in fact, it was a central part of the white paper that there would be some review board that would act as a body that would ensure that ICANN did not act in an arbitrary or capricious way or acted outside of its authority, and that board was never established. At the ACRA meeting, the explanation was that they couldn't find enough the nominating committee. They couldn't find enough people to work on the nominating committee who were willing to spend the time coming up with nominations for the independent review commission. So they felt that it was not worth pursuing. It was more work, more effort than the benefit would yield. So, I mean, that's sort of the history of this, and I think, but Marilyn is talking about something which is completely different than a complaint department or a consumer ombudsman.
Okay, thank you for the clarification. Howard, you're next.
I want to emphasize what Marilyn said and what others have now said about the difference of an ombudsman and an independent review panel, and I want to stress a very important point that in addition to addressing ourselves to what we think is going to work, which is important, there is also an element of that is legitimacy. And without some clear way to address real problems by the board of that are perceived by the board of directors and get them resolved, and see that they are absolved in an objective and fair manner, there is no way that ICANN is going to be regarded ultimately as legitimate. Those who disagree with it will always be able to point with some justification that the board is going rogue, disregarding, behaving in an arbitrary manner, and disregarding its binding documents. So I think that this is just an issue that we cannot ignore. It's really a matter of accountability rather than transparency, which is what this issue is raised. We really got to move on to it, even if we can't come to an agreement as to how we're going to do it.
Okay, Harold, thanks for that clarification and statement. I think there's broad agreement that such an independent review body should indeed have two functions. And I'll be saying that the first function of that is basically independent review of the decisions of the ICANN board. That seemed to be what Roger was saying. And if that's the case, then can we capture it if we change sentence one to read, create a committee for independent review
of the decisions of the ICANN board and to oversee the work of a special ombudsman.
Philip,
does that
Marilyn,
work?
Marilyn, yeah. Let me clarify. Roger's explanation was extremely helpful, and Roger, we should probably make sure the minutes note that we seem to be in agreement. This could be a first for this main council. But I do want to be clear that what we are saying is to deal with appeals, not to take every decision of the board under review, right? We are talking about an appeals process or a review that an appeal could be made to.
Okay, so we're saying an independent review of appealed decisions of the ICANN board.
That would be my recommendation.
I would agree with that, and I think that's been the spirit of the intent all along. If you wanted to drill down further, the concept of a review commission is not that it's sort of is a higher decision-making body, but it reviews the actions of the board against sort of established ground rules or established criteria or something like that. It's not supposed to be the next layer of next higher layer of management. It's the control to avoid abuse or something like that. So
yeah.
It depends on how fine a point you want to make on it.
Okay, I'm very happy with that.
That's great.
Thank you for wording. Bruce, you want to speak?
I'll just suggest, and I agree with the comments that Marilyn and Roger have made. I'd rather you just remove the words professional ombudsman from this recommendation altogether. I think we need to separate an independent review process from an ombudsman process, because they're completely different things. The independent review process, given what people have said, and I would agree, I wonder whether the second sentence is actually right, because I'm not sure that you want past board members necessarily being in that independent review, because that's all
we'll take those in stages.
Yeah.
Can I comment on Bruce's thought about the coverage of the ombudsman as well? I think you could do it either way. It is conceivable that you could give this independent review commission authority to oversee the work of the ombudsman, in the sense that, you know, it's supposed to be an independent body, and it would make the ombudsman a little bit more independent if there was an external group that was overseeing their work. But it doesn't. But it's not a normal management thing to do. That's correct. The ombudsman reports directly to the CEO, and the CEO is his boss and tells him what to do and what not to do. So it's I guess I basically agree with you, but I don't think it's necessary to cut out the ombudsman reference if people want to keep it in.
All I'm just saying is that should be a separate recommendation regarding the ombudsman, because it's a separate issue to independent review. In the title of the
treaty. Okay, so you don't disagree with the existence of an ombudsman, you just think we should be clear that these are separate functions.
Yes.
So your preference would be to have a recommendation 17, which is to say create the role of a professional ombudsman. I'm very happy with that change, if we want to do that. So what we're saying at the moment would read recommendation 16, first sentence, create a committee for independent review of appeal the decisions of the ICANN board, full stop. And we have a separate recommendation 17, which says create the role of professional ombudsman. And we now need to discuss second sentence of recommendation 16 in terms of who may be appropriate. We're just giving some ideas here. We're saying the committee could comprise a designee of the GAC, a designee of the IAB. And there's been questions raised about should or should not past board members be on that. And in this case, we would say presumably not the ombudsman, because that delineates the role. Comments then on who we may recommend as possible candidates for the independent review committee. Who would like to speak on that? Marilyn, anybody else?
Roger, too.
Roger, anybody else?
Harold,
anybody else?
Jay Scott.
Bruce
Thompson.
Anybody else? Okay, Marilyn.
My first comment is going to be a slide edit, and I'll be very clear on why I want to make this change. Although I'll probably be in trouble as soon as this appears in the minutes. The IAB is not actually representative of the IETF, and that's something that sometimes we all forget. Perhaps what we should do is a simple edit there might be a designee of the IAB / IETF, which might just the IAB is elected to do certain functions, but it actually doesn't represent or speak for the IETF. So that would be a simple change and one that probably would be appreciated by the technical community and actually broaden who they might be able to draw on. The question of finding the rest of the representatives, I think it's going to be very, very challenging, and I'm wondering if we want to maybe focus on a few sentences of description of characteristics rather than on the pool from which those people are drawn.
Okay, Roger.
I guess it's a similar point. I think that the only essential characteristic of a review board that's going to be reviewing ICANN board decisions is that it be made up of people who are independent of the ICANN board itself. Obviously, the only thing you couldn't have is the board reviewing itself. So, you know, I would say, beyond the question of ensuring that the members are independent of ICANN and the ICANN board, I'm not sure that we have to start getting specific about whether they should come from the International Chamber of Commerce or from the IETF or from the XYZ. It just seems to me that they need to be people at the policy level. I'm hard pressed to find a policy matter other than that they have to be completely independent of ICANN and the ICANN board. So I'm not even sure we have to go down to the level of saying where they come from, other than that they need to be sort of competent people who are completely independent of ICANN and the ICANN board.
Okay, Harold.
Yes, I want to agree and expand on that last point, which is that if we should not replicate the land rush that we are having on board representation. I mean, the problem is if we are going to try to designate specific representations, then everybody is going to rush in and try to make sure that they themselves are covered in the review committee. I do think we do need to pay some attention to the process of how the review committee would be selected to guarantee that independence. My own personal feeling is that as an accountability mechanism, which is what I see this as rather than a transparency mechanism, this seems to be much more an accountability mechanism, this might be where it is more profitable to have governments or direct elections in the review capacity rather than directly in the board capacity. But again, I would address that to the process of how it's selected rather than trying to designate specific representation on the review committee.
Okay. I think everybody's moving in the direction here of cutting the second sentence, but let's carry on. Jay Scott.
My only comment would be is if we keep the second sentence that we put in the introductory prepositional phrase, by way of example only, comma, the committee that comprise.
Okay.
I know that the could seems to suggest we're not giving specific recommendations, but I think, again, stating the obvious never hurts.
Really? Jay Scott, thanks for that. Bruce?
My view is that I would rather see one of the issues I think Stuart Lynn had, and it seems reading through his document that he didn't really like the idea of having independent review at all, and I think he's concerned he doesn't want a higher authority where, let's say, you make a particular opinion and you effectively go over their heads because you didn't get the answer you want and try and get the answer you want from someone else. I think the independent review, I think picking up on what Roger was saying earlier, I'd rather it was a bit more of a judicial process. In other words, that it is actually looking to see that the board has operated in accordance with its constitution, not whether the particular policy is correct or not.
And so from that point of view, I think the way we're talking, the danger is, and when people start talking about, we should start voting the members of the review panel, once you start doing that, you're actually giving it some higher authority, and that's not really the point, I think. I'd rather it be comprising of people perhaps from more of a court or judicial background, not necessarily with any internet knowledge at all, but that actually can just look at it from a purely process point of view.
Okay, I think what I propose to do is to delete the second sentence of that, if in future discussion we want to add any flesh to thoughts there, then please email that in wording, and we can add that to future recommendations. So for an agreement, we have recommendation 16, reading, create a committee for independent review, independent review of appeal the decisions of the ICANN board, full stop. Recommendation 17, create the role of a special ombudsman. If we're all happy with that, we would move on to our next agenda item, which is policy development.
I don't know if it's a point of order or point of language. Just given that ombudsman is a Swedish word, you would create an office of ombudsman here. You would create a role.
With the office of... Okay, fine. Happy to accept that as a friendly amendment. If we're happy, we'll move on to discuss policy development.
Philip.
Elizabeth.
I have just one point which has been mentioned by CCTLD members, that very often, and it is a shortcut, when you speak, you use the word registry and registrar without specifying for registry that you speak about GTLD registry, because we have GTLD registry and CCTLD registry. And I will be sending over email to save our time over call, but there is one or two places I would like to specify to which registry we refer in our recommendations. Is that correct, or was I cut from telephone?
No, Elizabeth, but could you repeat your question?
Roger, very often I noted it in minutes and in various texts when Philip speak about registry, GTLD registry, he forget to say GTLD registry and say registry.
Ah, I see. Okay. Yes.
Oh, sorry, I believe it is just minor clarification, but necessary, because I was reminded by my CCTLD colleague about importance.
Yeah, so you're particularly talking about Recommendation 5, I assume, because Recommendation 5 talks about funding and revenues administered by registrars and registries. You probably mean by GTLD registrars and GTLD registries.
It is the one, but I was referring, for instance, to Recommendation 1, Mission... the last line says registry and registrar contract enforcement. It is referring to GTLD registry and registrar contract enforcement.
At least now there is a .au registry agreement with ICANN.
Well, it is not referring to CCTLD, and it is important to ourselves.
Won't it at some point apply to CCTLD?
Hi, Philip is back here, having just got cut off. Where has the discussion got?
Can we leave this particular discussion so when Elizabeth sends in her her email and then respond to it online? Because
sure.
That might be helpful in clarifying.
Absolutely.
Okay, Elizabeth, I got cut off when we were talking about language of registry for the stars, but that had been, I note that, I'm happy to take any changes of language for clarification if you wanted to make those. Shall we move on to discuss policy development? I take that as a yes. Who would like to start discussion? Names.
I will, since I raised it.
Bishop, does this occur at any particular point, or are we just talking about a theme?
We're about to frame our discussion. What we had discussed... last time was that under advisory bodies of policy development there were details
of the way policy development would take place, constituencies versus forums.
Okay, so there's no language to look at this point.
There's no language to look at, no, exactly.
Thank you.
It's a board discussion. So I have Marilyn in queue. Who else?
I'll go.
So Harold. Harold, who else? Okay, Marilyn, kick off.
What I'd like to do is, first of all, to suggest that from the BC point of view, our suggestion is that we fix the policy development process by adding structure, time frames, and staff support, and focus on talking about the policy development process in this particular section, rather than in any great detail what the structure would be that policy development takes place in.
Okay, Harold.
I'd like to toss out for this discussion something that's a frequent flyer in the policy development in a number of fora that I think are really essential in the policy development structure. And one of them is that there has to be some understanding of the roadmap that policy development is going to follow, and it has to be specific. There has to be a clearly defined point at which the public can comment, a clearly defined way in which those comments are actually answered and addressed. One of the real problems in the current structure is, number one, it's very hard to tell where actual decisions are going to be made despite what it says in the bylaws. And number two, nothing is ever, there's never an ultimate explanation of why a decision is made. The board just goes and rolls out a resolution and votes without any kind of formal discussion of why we did or didn't do something, which leads people who do participate and whose views are not accepted or reflected in the final result to feel as if they are, spinning down a well. Nobody expects to win every time or even most of the time, but there has to be, if there's going to be genuine public involvement, there has to be listened to, and that this is process, not for show. And finally, as we touched on previously, there has to be some method of accountability so that policies that are made are within the defined guidelines. I think the Independent Review Committee may serve as an appropriate accountability mechanism if the selection process for that committee gives it legitimacy.
Okay, you raised an important point there about public commentary on policies and identifying where decisions are made. I think perhaps on that second one would be a good point for discussion. At present, we in principle have a structure where the constituencies discuss and following a process of consultation, outreach, etc. If there is then two-thirds support, a policy is in principle made, and the board should act upon that. Do we see that same obligatory role of the policy development body to be something that we wish to maintain? Who would like to speak to that question?
Sorry, would you state the question again?
The question is, do we think that the current form whereby the advisory bodies are making policy which the board acts upon is the model we want versus the advisory bodies versus bodies providing advice which the board and the board then sets policy?
Okay, I will speak to that, but I just want to clarify again that they are not, in my view, they are not merely advisory bodies, they are policy development bodies. And I do strongly recommend that we maintain that approach to policy development. So it's a policy development body, whatever we call it, whether we call it an SO or a policy development body or something of that nature, but it develops policy that is agreed to, and then put forward to the board. The board ratifies policy. I do think the board should have the ability to identify, based on complaints or other occurrences, the need for a policy to be addressed and to be able to direct the staff to or the policy advisory bodies to undertake a fast-track work effort on policy. But for the most part, policy should be developed, generated, and put forward.
And the board ratifying. Okay, does everybody agree with that as a general comment?
Yeah, this is Ken Stubbs. Can I make a comment?
Ken, let me just take a cue then. Ken, I had, was it Bruce from Tipping Course there?
Yes.
Who else? Hey, Scott. Hey, Scott. Who else? Okay, Ken.
I'm somewhat confused because I think what it sounds like to me is we have a case where the tail's wagging the dog. I think that policy development is essential, but at the same point in time, a policy development goes to the board for review and action. If the board determines that the policy isn't consistent with the mission, goals, charter, structure, whatever it may be, of the entity itself, then I think the board has to, its principal responsibility is to the entity. And if you're not happy with the way your representatives are acting on the board, then it's incumbent on you to replace them. But I don't see a circumstance where the board sits there and rubber stamps actions at the lower level. And also, would you put me in a queue at some point in time, respond to a comment that Harold made earlier? I'll do it in a more appropriate forum, though.
Sure. Ken, we did have a recommendation 10, which was saying that policy recommendation from the policy development bodies should be ordinarily binding on the board and other ICANN entities, but with objection possible subject to a two-thirds board majority. So we're recognizing there that the board should have power to act as a board, but only under exceptional circumstances, and things should ordinarily binding on the board there.
Well, you see, the problem there is that you have a hole you could drive a truck through. First of all, somebody has to determine as to whether or not it should be binding, and then if they determine that it should be binding, then the board has the responsibility under the recommendation to either accept it or reject it, and if they reject it, then they need a two-thirds majority. But if somebody determines that this policy isn't binding anyway, then the board doesn't have to worry about accepting or rejecting it. So, I mean, what you've done is we've made a recommendation that, in effect, has is too vague to be effectively implemented on a regular basis. All somebody has to do to reject the policy is to say that we've determined that it's not binding on us, and therefore we don't even have to worry about accepting or rejecting it as a policy recommendation. So,
and I think that is precisely what we're trying to determine now, isn't it? Isn't that what we're meaning by discussion of policy development? I mean, what you're saying is a good, you know, is the right question, is what I'm saying. So perhaps we can address that in a moment. Bruce?
Yeah, my view is that the primary place where the policy should be developed is in the policy-making bodies. To my mind, the primary role of the board is to see that an appropriate process was applied by that policy-making body. In other words, that there was sufficient outreach and that all the views were taken into account in developing the policy. The other thing I would just add is I think the board needs the ability to make, if you like, interim decisions or interim policy while something is being worked out. One of the issues at the moment, I think, is that ICANN is not responsive to problems in the marketplace, and I think it needs to be able to be responsible, but to be responsive to issues. And that might mean making an interim decision based on the information I have available at the time. And then the issue gets then sent to a policy council for proper policy development process. And then they adhere to the policy at the outcome of that. But the board, a bit like what Ken is saying, but I think the board does need to have the ability to make decisions in a timely manner.
Okay, that's an interesting point in terms of making decision making quick when it needs to be. Jay Scott, you're next.
First, a comment to the last comment directly. While I don't have a problem with that, what I see a problem in just practicality speaking. If I'm a regulated party, such as a registrar and registry, and I need to develop a protocol or a service that is being demanded by change in circumstances or a situation that requires an extensive capital input from my entity in order to do, and the board gives me interim passage to do so, but I understand that that can be revoked once a policy body decides that it is not a good idea, I'm not going to do it. I would never act on an interim decision knowing that it can be taken away, because I'm not just not going to invest my capital in a pipe dream. So that's problematic from that particular model I see. I did notice in the BC position that there was some talk of a fast track to handle certain issues, and perhaps that would be a better situation. You know, you still run the risk that an independent review body could say that the decision was outside the scope of ICANN's power, violation. There's still some risk, but not as great a risk, I believe, as an interim action. Next, with regard to the specific issues, I think that the ICANN board itself needs to be involved in the management of policy development by being assigned certain duties, either by issue or by group that they interface with directly, that they are involved with this. I think that it is unrealistic to think that their only involvement should be to ensure that the policy development follows a certain process. One, that gets us mirrored and bogged down in exactly what Stewart's main criticism of the current ICANN structure is, which is we do nothing but argue about process. So that draws some concern to me. Secondly, I think it's very difficult to get dedicated, educated people that can bring something to the ICANN process, the ICANN decision-making process of value, if they are so hand-tied that they cannot see the forest for the tree and say two-thirds of the board has decided that the policy recommendation has these highlights which we are going to act upon. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 are way over the top. And rather than having to, under the current structure as it's supposed to work, and I know Harold would disagree and say it does not work this way in reality, push the entire recommendation back down and say, okay, fix it. They should be able to exercise their discretion so long as it's the necessary supermajority. As far as policy development is concerned, I think you all have seen the IPC paper, and one of the ideas that we have floated for discussion is that perhaps we would, and this, the idea behind this is not necessarily to relieve ICANN stakeholders of policy-making authority or the ability to participate in that process. It was perhaps an idea that would relieve some of the financial stress that ICANN claims it faces with managing this process by exporting ideas, issues that are identified by the policy development bodies. For example, Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy, most of that public discussion was taken place on WIPO forums that were conducted around the world. ICANN did nothing. They didn't fund it. They didn't do anything. WIPO did it all. Then they brought back a recommendation to the board that was then discussed in the public forums and discussed throughout ICANN, and then acted upon in such a way that a small drafting committee and the ultimate policy was drafted through the ICANN process. And so we identified a model that perhaps we could use an import-export model where issues are identified and then exported out, brought to the board's attention, and the board can either select a committee that will handle this particular decision made up of certain experts, such as they did with the redemption grace period, where they selected certain affected parties and experts, or people with areas of expertise rather than experts, to function on that and bring back a recommendation to the board that would then receive public comment. And that's the proposal that we've put forth as an idea for discussion.
Disco, I think the idea you suggest is very interesting. Going back to your earlier point about greater board involvement in decision making, and clearly the model you're talking about is part of that. Would you envisage that? I mean, the way that we work at the moment, Names Council creates, you know, smaller groups. We call them task forces. We have certain people who are involved in those. I mean, would you envisage that those smaller, you know, working groups, whatever we wish to call them, would have board involvement as well? I mean, would you potentially see sort of somebody from the board would be chairing that discussion within the policy development bodies? Is that the sort of thing you're considering?
Basically, this is taken from the INTA model, whereby the board, and in that model, it's the officers, who don't necessarily have officers at ICANN, are responsible for overseeing certain large groups of policy. One particular group that I'm involved with is the TAPS group, and that's a lot of small committees underneath that. And that person is directly responsible for overseeing that process works. They are responsible for that. It's not just they sit up at the front of a room, a large group of people, and listen to complaints and problems that everyone has. They are actively involved. They attend the meetings. They don't vote on any of those things, but they are responsible for managing that process. And you report back to those individuals your progress in those. So they are actively engaged, not necessarily making policy, but they are engaged in the process itself so that they have an active management rather than just reviewing some report or letter or position paper and then drawing from it, trying to make some sort of decision based on process, based on not having participated and overseen that in an active basis.
Okay, that sounds quite interesting, because I mean, so rather than the board sitting back and saying, oh, we asked the DNSO for their opinion and they've told us nothing yet, it would be somebody sitting there saying, oh, well, I failed to make things work in terms of getting this policy through the system.
Yes, and they would come back and they would say, we haven't heard anything yet. They would say, you know, here's what's happened, boom, 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 because they would know. They wouldn't be, you know, there would be some sort of formalized structure where they are responsible for keeping the board up to date, rather than the board just having this overbroad overview to get board members involved in the management of this process.
Let's take a new cue as we had some fresh thoughts there. So I'm hearing Marilyn for that cue. Who else?
Bruce Duncan.
Bruce, who else? No, Marilyn first.
I'd like to just say a couple of words, Scott, about the example you gave. Many associations, trade associations and nonprofit associations, having spent 10 years in that world before I found a home in the commercial sector, many professional organizations use a model where the board members or a representative of a board member company takes a chair role in a policy committee. But the bulk of the work is still done in terms of drafting, scheduling, etc. The bulk of the work is still done by professional paid staff and not reliant on volunteers and the time of volunteers. That model is helpful because I would agree with Jay Scott that what it does is it provides a direct path of information not just from the paid staff who report to the executive director and provide input, but it provides a direct path of information from the board member or whoever's working for them who's chairing a policy development process, so that it increases the flow of communication. But I've never seen it work effectively, and I really want to make a strong point about this. The board members already complain about being overburdened about the amount of work that they carry. And I think we need to be careful in our assumption. These are not paid board members. We need to be careful in our assumption about how much work a board member could take on in the policy observation process. I'm not ready to go to a model which has the board members chairing policy development. I do think they could and should be assigned or given encouragement to participate in the policy process in some way. And that could be attending constituency meetings. It could be participating in some other way.
But, madam, would you accept, I suppose, a working group is set up to determine a certain issue. If you say you wouldn't be happy with the board taking a chair role of that working group, you'd nevertheless be happy with the board being a member of that group.
No, I'm voting. If they want to observe, fine. My priority is to have staff that does work.
Sure. No, I mean, as well, I'm saying not in place of. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think the board should be in a voting role, and I don't think that they should be chairing.
Okay. Bruce?
I guess sort of a mixture of comments there. I'm aware in the outer process in Australia at the moment, the policy groups have generally had independent chairs, which have been outside of the board members, and then those independent chairs then brief the board on a sort of, a personal level, so that the board actually as a whole then meets with the chair of that policy council and talks through all the issues and explains the discussions. We do also have an instance where a board member has chaired a committee, and I haven't seen any problem with that either. I think the key objective is that the board needs to be more involved in terms of the progress of policy development, and I think having, as Marilyn said, a couple of board members involved and attending some constituency meetings and so on, in terms of outreach so that they understand the issues. But I don't see that they need to be voting in that capacity, but they could certainly be involved in task forces and so on as non-voting members to be across the process. But the key issue that has made things work in the Australian context has been full-time staff have been allocated to help manage the process of the committees, and they make sure that at the end of the day a coherent document is produced at the end of it. And they also tend to manage receiving input from the public and collecting all that input together, presenting that input to the committee. The committee then has to respond to that input, and that full-time support person then effectively writes the response as a result of that.
Okay, thanks for that, Bruce. Perhaps just in the last 10 minutes or so of this call, let's exchange views on the stakeholders in these policy development bodies, and specifically the question of constituencies as we have now, who have typically self-formed at some point and elect to a representatives of the Names Council. They elect to the decision-making body of that advisory organization, versus the idea that Stuart was floating of a number of forums. And in discussion there, I think we need to make a distinction between the adding to constituencies, which is a separate argument in the same way that we believe constituencies work, versus the idea of replicating as many different forums or other groups of overlapping interests, if you want, who would participate in some way, as yet to be explained in detail, I think, in Stuart's proposal, in that process. So constituencies versus forums, views on that. Who would like to comment?
Harold Feld, I'd like to comment.
Harold, anybody else?
Marilyn.
Marilyn, anybody else? Okay, Harold, start.
I have a couple of points. The first, as regards to this constituency versus fora, there needs to be a distinction here between the outreach and notification function and the actual process by which policy is made. Loads of diverse fora are very useful for outreach to potentially affected constituencies and with affected stakeholders, and for encouraging general discussion, bringing in people who are involved. But if you try to use that as a policy development mechanism, you are going to really exhaust folks who cannot tell where they should put their input. I cannot stress enough that for the vast majority of NGOs, we have very scarce resources. There are typically a limited number of issues on which you know, we can speak, despite you know, having a very broad range of concerns. And so it's very important for us in our community to know where we have to go to get the most, you know, bang for our very limited buck.
So are you saying, Harold, then, that what's perhaps more important is not necessarily being everybody being part of the decision making process, but a process being in place whereby when a decision is about to happen, as many people are as appropriate are notified? Is that the distinction you're trying to make?
I think that is one distinction, although I wouldn't put values to it. I was just pointing out that they are entirely separate functions, and I think that fora are very good at the outreach function and making sure. And in policy development, there are a number of things that have to happen for it to have legitimacy. One is that there really has to be some way in which people who think their interests are going to be affected can monitor and find out and have meaningful input. On the other hand, you also don't want the situation that happens too often in ICANN where you know, people work very diligently on something and then a latecomer comes along and, you know, sort of upsets the whole apple cart. That's, you know, so, but there has to be some, both an outreach function so that people who want to monitor this can understand it, and also a clearly defined policy step-by-step that goes on so that people who do want to intervene know where they can intervene. Otherwise, you end up racing around all over the place and not accomplishing anything.
Okay, but can I get in queue, Philip, Tony Harris?
Yep, Tony, you're
on
the queue.
Marilyn,
you're next. Marilyn, are you with us?
Are you able to hear me?
Can I?
Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay. I agree with a lot of what Harold just said and would make the following observation. One of the things that ICANN is abysmal at is what I call push communication. They list things on the website and people are, you know, sort of assumed that everybody monitors the ICANN website on a moment-by-moment basis. Very, very hard for anyone to have effective participation or even to know that a process way. So that would be one point that I would make, that regardless of what the mechanism is to take input on policy, that there has to be a much better distribution mechanism of just informing people that processes are going on and how to provide comments or input. Secondly, I've told Stuart this, so I might as well tell the world. I really think the idea that he laid out in you know, an ad hoc forum popping up here and an ad hoc forum popping up there was very irresponsible. Not to say that a organized approach to forums where people have something to respond to and know that their comment time is 3 weeks or 2 weeks and that if they provide comments that they will be organized and presented in a meaningful manner would not be a good thing to do. I think that could be a good augmentation. Up to now, we haven't had a very effective process like that. Thomas and
Alexander are working hard to improve that process within the GA, but we really haven't had an effective process by which people got organized around a topic and provided meaningful input. They've done that now in a couple, or we, I guess I should say, the community has done that now in a couple of cases. Forums, as described by Stuart, should not be seen as a substitute for a policy development process.
Okay, Tony Harris.
Yes, I'd like to say I agree with Marilyn, and I would also like to add, I think that what Stuart proposed as regards forums, or I believe he described the mechanism of spontaneously adding constituencies who might sort of come and go according to different issues. I think this is all a terrific idea, but they belong in the at-large. The at-large currently have 5 board members. I think they need a supporting organization who can give all these people Harold is concerned about a home, and they should be occupied with the outreach to all these forums or groups who might be affected with different issues that might come up now and then. Constituencies can't be created overnight. They have to have named council representatives. They must contribute to the named council budget, and they must have their bylaws. I don't think this is a very serious proposition myself.
Okay. Other comments on this topic before we close?
This is Jay Scott. I don't think we've yet answered the question that you've originally posed, which is, who's going to make up these policy, ICANN policy development bodies?
No, what I've been hearing from the speakers that we did have, though, was no support for the concept of fora as outlined by Stuart.
Yes.
And therefore I'm suspecting a degree of conservatism in terms of the current construct. But other
I would like to speak to the current construct and the rest of the question you asked.
Okay, Marilyn, speak to that. Jay Scott, do you want to speak to that, or are we just making a comment?
No, I'm interested to hear what others have to say.
Okay.
I think our IPZ position was that the advisory bodies, which is the term we used in our paper, should be perhaps organized along the same jurisdictional lines that they currently are, except for the exception of the creation of a country code top-level domain supported organization.
Yeah. Marilyn is going to speak. Anybody else want to speak on this?
Bruce Tonkin.
Bruce. Anybody else? Maybe one of our last cues. Okay, Marilyn.
The BC has published a statement, and it says Danny Younger says that many people don't understand it. I'll demystify it. We support the creation of 2 separate policy development entities, one focused on CCTLDs, one focused on generic TLDs. We want a strong, agreed-to relationship between the two when there are policies being developed that are of mutual interest and concern, such as international domain names, things of that nature. We think that the present constituency model within the present Means Council, absent the CCTLD, since we believe they'd be creating their own policy development entity, but relating to us, would largely be what it is today. If there are other constituencies that identify themselves and meet the criteria that Tony just established, they could be incorporated into this GTLD policy development body as well. There should be some mechanism to take input from the at-large, and the participation process that we supported as a BC that needed to be developed with the at-large, but we did not support bringing the at-large into the policy development organization. We suggested that there be a mechanism to take input from comments that the at-large provided on policy. So that could mean there would be the addition of an additional constituency or two that would have to have bylaws, be defined, meet the same kind of criteria that other constituencies meet.
Okay, Marion, thank you for that. Bruce?
Yeah, I think the registrars are roughly in that position as well. I think the registrars support
I guess, similar groups to the currently make up the DNSO as being a member of the policy council, and those groups would need to be properly organised, as Carolyn pointed out. I think the registrars are also okay with the concept of the board of ICANN being able to appoint a number of members in addition to those that are directly elected, if you like, by the constituency groups. And the purpose of that is really just to provide a bit more balance, perhaps provide some additional skills that aren't available on the policy council up to date. So I think we accept the concept of needing some change, and so it's not purely a political organisation, that there are some people with real expertise on the group as well.
Okay, Bruce, thanks for that. I think we're now past the hour, and I suppose that we end the call here. I will, as previously, attempt to capture some of that last discussion in a series of new recommendations, which we can then fine-tune, hopefully by email. Please do input by email, if not on our next call, when we will also cover those questions we talked about earlier to do with the board composition, non-voting or voting, how to elect the rest of the board, and what may be the size, or at least some bracketing of the size of the board that we would see, and maybe carry on some of the discussions we've just had now. In order to submit something formally, as said before, I will submit our report as edited on this call up until recommendation 17 as an interim report to the committee that Alejandro is chairing. Although I think, as many of you may have seen, he's been monitoring quite closely our discussions and shared documentation. So there was a degree of what we'd already been discussing appearing in their own committee's interim report, which was posted this week. Our next call is in a fortnight's time, is that right? Yep, on Tuesday the 14th of May. So that's a Tuesday, not a Thursday that week, please note. But otherwise, the hour is the same. And on that note, if there's nothing else, I will thank you very much for your